Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century by Michael Hiltzik. Narrated by Norman Dietz. Copyright 2010 by Michael Hiltzik. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Michael Hiltzik, care of the Sandra Dykstra Literary Agency, and was produced in the year 2010 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Introduction. September 30, 1935. Roosevelt comes to the river. The president's train lumbered across the desert in the dead of night. The darkness was opportune, for it spared the passengers, those still awake as Sunday night edged into Monday morning, the sight of the wasteland they were traveling on this, the fourth day of an exhausting coast-to-coast journey. One of the most desolate landscapes in the United States, it was a vast, flat desert without a hint of green, its few human settlements separated from one another by hundreds of waterless miles. For generations, hardy or foolhardy Americans had crossed this territory in search of fortune or fulfillment, looking for gold, water, a patch of land to homestead, or the answer to a dream. Thousands had perished in the quest. In making the same crossing, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was on a quest of his own. He aimed to appropriate as a tangible symbol of the New Deal his Democratic administration's economic recovery program, a great dam on the Colorado River, conceived and launched by Republicans. To that end, he'd resolved to dedicate this landmark of human achievement in person at a ceremony scheduled for the coming day. He would speak directly to a crowd of 10,000 from a shaded podium beside the monumental work, while his words were carried across the land on a nationwide radio hookup. FDR worked long past midnight, laying down his words on yellow-lined tablets in his angular longhand. This was his second full draft, the first having been unanimously panned earlier that evening by a review chorus composed of Interior Secretary Harold Ickes, Federal Reserve Chairman Mariner Eccles, whose own Utah construction company had helped build the dam, and his press secretary, Steve T. Early. All thought it was below par and didn't do the president justice, Ickes reported in his diary. The result was that he had to do it all over again. The new version would carry a full helping of the Roosevelt magic. As he began to speak just before noon on that sizzling Monday, the president, strapped uncomfortably upright into a steel frame attached to a shaded lectern, first evoked the arid landscape on which thousands of Americans had scratched out a living for years, enthralled to the menacing moods of the Colorado River. For a generation, the people of Imperial Valley had lived in the shadow of disaster from this river, he said. Every spring they awaited with dread the coming of a flood, and at the end of nearly every summer they feared a shortage of water would destroy their crops. The dam had already vindicated the foresight of its builders, he observed, for only a few months earlier a great flood had cascaded down from the mountains and would surely have ruined the settlers of the valley had it not been caught and safely held behind the huge concrete rampart. Next he turned his attention to the future, describing the rich bounty of electricity, water, and recreation to be provided by the man-made lake, 115 miles long, that had begun to fill behind the dam. Transmission lines of unprecedented length already spanned the desert, ready to bring electricity to factories, street lights, and household appliances in towns and cities hundreds of miles away. The cities of Southern California had broken ground for yet another engineering marvel, an immense aqueduct to transport the Colorado's waters over the mountains to quench the thirst of millions of residents on the coastline. More gifts were in the offing. Agriculture, mining, and manufacturing, not to speak of industries yet unforeseen, all would be nourished by the dam. They await the development of cheap power, Roosevelt said. The national benefits which will be derived from the completion of this project will make themselves felt in every one of the 48 states. FDR envisioned the project in a way that his predecessor, Herbert Hoover, the once and future namesake of what was then known as Boulder Dam, would have found entirely alien, as a symbol. The dam signified not only man's mastery over nature, he observed, but also a people's ability to find greatness by coalescing into a social and economic community. The dam's $108 million cost, including interest, might seem a large number at first blush, Roosevelt said, but as the price of nationwide inspiration and the creation of a template for further public works, it would be reckoned modest indeed. As the largest federal project of its kind, Hoover Dam, to use the name Congress made permanent in 1947, inaugurated an age of grand national undertakings. Emboldened by the successful effort to harness the Colorado, the United States embarked on a campaign to place more of its rivers and streams under human domination. Within a year of Roosevelt's address, three more dams, Bonneville, Grand Coulee, and Shasta, were under construction, all ranking with Hoover Dam as among the biggest in history. The Tennessee Valley Authority, born in the Hundred Days, the frenzy of legislative action at the very inception of Roosevelt's term, would eventually encompass 29 hydroelectric dams. FDR called constantly for even more projects, like a man under a spell. "How about it?" he would scribble to Ickes during cabinet meetings. "Can we survey? Can we take the money from here and put it there? Can we do it?" Seven more dams soon rose on the Colorado itself, choking it so completely that its once mighty flow into the Gulf of California has been reduced today to a brackish stream of runoff from Mexican farms. Hoover Dam inspired much more than irrigation works. Even before its last concrete was poured, construction of the Golden Gate Bridge was underway, involving some of the same contractors. More bridges and tunnels followed, along with the first freeways. The power of America's concerted will and intellectual resources, demonstrated so decisively by Hoover Dam's construction, would continue to reveal itself over the succeeding years. In times of acute crisis, as after Pearl Harbor, at D-Day, and in the Manhattan Project, and in times of more placid, if not entirely tranquil, aspiration, as during the 1950s and 1960s, which bequeathed to us the interstate highway system and man's landing on the moon. Franklin Roosevelt instinctively grasped the totemic power of what he called the greatest dam in the world, its elegant machine beauty and opalescent majesty. He foretold in his opening words the spell it would cast on every visitor. "This morning I came, I saw, and I was conquered, as everyone would be who sees for the first time this great feat of mankind." Hundreds of thousands of visitors had preceded him, peering over the canyon rim during the construction phase at the ant-like workers 700 feet below. Afterward, 1 million tourists a year would heed his call to come to Boulder Dam and see it with your own eyes. Movie companies set their melodramas against the backdrop of the dynamiting of cliffsides and the pouring of concrete. Novelists nudged their plots into motion with mysterious events unfolding in the dam's shadow. Advertisers posed their cars and trucks against its elegant outlines. Poets sang of its flawless beauty. To the leftist English novelist and playwright J.B. Priestley, the structure heralded the advent of the new socialist man. This is what it can do when given a real job. This is a first glimpse of what chemistry and mathematics and engineering and large-scale organization can accomplish when collective planning unites and inspires them, he wrote. You might be tempted to call it a work of art, as if something that began with civil engineering ended somewhat in the neighborhood of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. As a federal project, Hoover Dam was the first manifestation of the clamorous ascendant West's expanding influence in Washington, and became the instrument of the region's further empowerment. Its water and hydroelectricity helped turn California into the most politically weighty state of the Union, fueled the development of the isolated cities of the Southwest into the bustling Sunbelt metropolises that continue today to drain eastern cities of money, population, and talent, and transform the entire region into a seedbed of new industries. Had the dam never been built, the West would look very different today. The growth of the urban areas most dependent on the river for water and power, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Denver, Salt Lake City, and San Diego, would have been stunted, leaving them at a fraction of their current size. The largest city on the West Coast today might well be San Francisco or Seattle, which get their water and power from other sources. But it was built. The transformation of America that took place during the post-World War II period really began a decade earlier with the completion of Hoover Dam. The story of America in the last half of the 20th century is the story not of the post-war era, but the post-dam era. The United States became, in that post-dam era, a country very different from the United States that built it. It was transformed from a society that glorified individualism into one that cherished shared enterprise and communal social support. To be sure, that change was not all the making of the dam itself. Social Security, the Works Progress Administration, and other New Deal programs forged in the crucible of the Depression played their essential role, as did the years of war. But the dam was the physical embodiment of the initial transformation, a remote regional construction project reconfigured into a symbol of national pride. The dam's durability in that role warrants a new examination of its creation and its legacy. Gazing upon it today, we're reminded of a more innocent era when American might and engineering seemed invincible, even under the crushing weight of economic crisis. The dam's imposing mass seems to ask whether we as a nation are still capable of such an undertaking today. Whether we would still have the drive and resourcefulness to conceive it, build it, and even finish it an astonishing 2 years ahead of schedule. A modern perspective requires us also to ask other darker questions. Among them is whether it was right to build the dam even then. For all that Los Angeles, San Diego, Denver, Phoenix, and Las Vegas owe to the dam their evolution into modern metropolises, these city-states have also become its prisoners, and the would-be human masters of the Colorado have become, in a real sense, its dependents. 30 million Americans, 10% of the country's population, were enticed westward by its abundance. But the region's population now faces the sobering truth that the river's gift was never as extravagant as generations of reclamation promoters had promised. The Colorado could only give so much, and in recent decades it's reached its limits. The question of how to conserve the river's bounty in an era of drought is also part of the story of Hoover Dam. Hoover Dam made a new West, but it also confined it in a straitjacket. the millions lured across the frontier to settle and build soon discovered that they were still subject to the river's ancient vicissitudes. To be sustained by the river, their descendants still must understand its rhythms and moods, even placate its spirits. For when the river runs dry, as it will do from time to time, much more is at stake than ever before. The beneficiaries of the river are no longer tribespeople growing staples on its banks between floods and droughts, but great cities and great industries. The ancients knew that attempting to control the Colorado was folly, but the moderns have had to learn the lesson anew. This book tells the story of that discovery and its consequences. Hoover Dam was not solely the product of the thousands of men who applied tools to rock and poured concrete from 1931 to 1936, and whose work was honored by Franklin Roosevelt with the closing words of his dedication, "Well done." The impulse to build it was born long before it began rising in concrete columns from the bedrock. Before the dam came, there were 250,000 acres of desert, peopled by a few scattered tribes and penetrated by a few lonely pioneers hoping to claim that land for vigorous cultivation by taming the river. But the river, often depicted in folk tales not as a reposeful stream, but as a serpent or dragon capable of unleashing horrific destruction without a moment's warning, would not be easily subdued. Part 1. The Sinful River. Chapter 1. The Journey of Death. By any customary measure, the Colorado River is an unremarkable stream. It doesn't rank as the longest river in North America, nor the widest, nor the most abundant. Its drainage basin of 250,000 square miles barely falls within the 10 largest in the United States, and much of it covers inaccessible range or desolate wasteland. Unlike the Mississippi, Hudson, and St. Lawrence, to name three great riparian thoroughfares of the continent, the Colorado has never been a significant bearer of commercial traffic. Throughout history, what has set the Colorado River apart from all other waterways of the Western Hemisphere is its violent personality. The Colorado has always been best known for the scars it left on the landscape, among them the greatest of all natural works, the Grand Canyon, a testament to the river's primordial origin and its compulsive energy. No river equaled its maniacal zeal for carving away the terrain in its path and carrying it downstream, sometimes as far as 1,000 miles. No river matched its schizophrenic moods, which could swing in the course of a few hours from that of a meandering country stream to an insane torrent. It's hardly surprising that from ancient times the humans who coexisted with the Colorado depicted it not as a beneficent, life-giving force, but as a fiery red monster, a dragon or serpent beyond man's ability to tame. The basin's first recorded inhabitants, the native tribespeople of the southern plains, had no option but to accommodate themselves to the river's implacable temperament. They pastured their livestock on the grass that sprang up in the wake of its floods, planted crops on its rich alluvial deposits, imagined their gods and spirits housed within its labyrinthine canyons, assembled their myths and legend from the raw material of its natural mystery. The American settlers of a later era, driven by the demands of commerce and dreams of wealth, were not so inclined to live in harmony with nature's unpredictable willfulness. From their earliest encounters with the river, they pondered how to corral it, divert it, drain it, and consume it. The California engineer Joseph Barlow Lippincott, dispatched to the river by the city of Los Angeles in 1912, pronounced it an American Nile awaiting regulation. to be best treated in as intelligent and vigorous a manner as the British government has treated its great Egyptian prototype. Lippincott's judgment reflected a new conservation policy then taking root in the United States. It was based on defining conservation not as protection or preservation, but as exploitation. Woodrow Wilson's Interior Secretary, Franklin K. Lane, laid out the new approach with striking directness. "Every tree is a challenge to us, and every pool of water and every foot of soil," he proclaimed. "The mountains are our enemies. We must pierce them and make them serve. The sinful rivers we must curb." Lane's successors answered his call to arms. Over the following decades, the U.S. government carried out an ambitious program to harness the sinful Colorado, working the river until the volume remaining to trickle into the sea scarcely merited an asterisk on a hydrological graph. The architects of this program couched their intentions in moral terms, as though they were not altering the natural order, but restoring the watershed to a state of grace. The Colorado River flows uselessly past the international desert which nature intended for its bride, wrote William Ellsworth Smythe, the most prominent water evangelist of his era, in 1900. "Sometime the wedding of the waters to the soil will be celebrated, and the child of that union will be a new civilization." What first lured Europeans to the banks of the Colorado, however, was not its potential to nurture crops. It was gold, or more precisely, the mirage of gold. The Spanish conquistadors, led by Hernan Cortes and Francisco Pizarro, had completed their plunder of the Inca and Aztec empires of the New World before the 16th century was three decades old. They'd looted the Indian storehouses, exhausted their mines, and worked legions of slaves to death. Yet their appetite for gold, silver, and gemstones remained unquenched. Fortuitously, hints of new treasures soon emerged from the uncharted north, re-energizing the Spanish quest. In the mid-1530s, adventurers returned from Indian imprisonment in the Sonoran Desert, present-day New Mexico and Arizona, laden with news of a land called Cibola, where stood seven magnificent cities in which, according to the yarn one traveler spun for his relatives, the women wore strands of gold and the men golden waistbands, and the palace walls were encrusted with emeralds. Lured by this vision of wealth, the conquistadors probed along the Sea of Cortez, the Gulf of California, until they encountered, inevitably, the Colorado Delta. The first advance parties were driven back by the ferocious tides at the confluence of the river and the gulf. Finally, in 1539, a ship under the tenacious command of Captain Hernando de Alarcón managed to sail upriver about 150 miles, penetrating well into Sonora. He was shortly followed by an immense force under the command of General Francisco Vázquez de Coronado, dispatched to explore the beckoning Golden Empire by land. Coronado's scouts were soon filling in the blank maps of the Southwest. They renamed the Colorado the Rio del Tizon, or Firebrand River, not because of its willfulness, but for the torches the local Indians bore on their travels, and they came upon the Grand Canyon, reporting the immense natural formation with appropriate wonderment. But their quest for gold failed. A Pueblo city that scouts had described as ringed with gilded ramparts proved to be built of mere mud and clay, which happened to glimmer deceptively in the setting sun. The other majestic cities of Cibola remained as elusive as mirages. For two more years, Coronado searched for gold, finally returning home empty-handed and deeply in debt. Yet there was gold in the north, just not where he'd been looking for it. Another 3 centuries would pass before its discovery would attract white Americans in great numbers back to what had long since been written off as a hopelessly unprepossessing territory. The gold rush of 1849 would draw 90,000 fortune seekers, known as 49ers or Argonauts, to ford the Colorado River, part of a migration of men, women, and families that's been called the largest single Western movement in the nation's history. The frenzy began with an unassuming item in an inside page of the San Francisco Californian of March 15, 1848, headlined, "Gold Mine Found." It did not fully take root in the national consciousness until 9 months later, when President James K. Polk gave the federal government's imprimatur to the discovery at Sutter's Mill. As an expansionist, Polk made no effort to downplay a discovery likely to encourage new settlement in an underpopulated region. Instead, he reported in his annual message to Congress on December 5th, that the explorations already made warrant the belief that the supply is very large. Some 300,000 Argonauts struck out for the West, a third of them taking what became known as the Southern Routes, overland byways converging at Yuma, Arizona, where the Gila River joined the Colorado, and continuing along one or another waterless trail or jornada toward the Pacific coast. These trails acquired a vicious reputation. One in particular, a desert crossing paralleling the Rio Grande in New Mexico, bore a label that presently was applied to the entire unspeakably harsh road west. It was known in Spanish as La Jornada de la Muerte, in English as the Journey of Death. Perils of every variety confronted travelers on the Jornada: disease, brigands, hostile tribes, and the daunting terrain itself. Not even the best outfitted expeditions were immune. This was shown by the dire experience of John Woodhouse Audubon, the renowned naturalist's younger son, who left New York for the Texas coast and points west with a party of 80, backed by what was regarded as lavish capital of $27,000. On the day of his departure, Audubon was a youthful 36, tall, strong, and alert, in the words of his daughter Maria. When he returned home a year later, he was broken, worn out in body and spirit by his travails on the Jornada and the loss at sea of all his sketches and most of his notebooks. The first blow to strike Audubon's company had been cholera, which killed 5 members within days of their landing in Texas and reduced a dozen others to dehydrated wraiths. The survivors pressed on, Audubon collecting botanical specimens and sketching wildlife in his father's style. In mid-October, he and his remaining companions reached the junction of the Gila and the Colorado, which he dismissed as merely a muddy stream. Crossing to the opposite bank and clambering up a sand dune, he perceived a further omen of the dismal prospects facing the expedition. He was perched upon a desert ridge that belonged to the Walking Hills of California, a natural barrier that would obstruct men's activities in the region for the next half century. There was not a tree to be seen, nor the least sign of vegetation, and the sun pouring down on us made our journey seem twice the length it really was. The next day, Audubon's group came upon a chain of fetid lagoons, where they had deduced the fate of their numberless predecessors from the detritus scattered on the ground. "Truly, here was a scene of desolation," he wrote. Broken wagons, dead, shriveled-up cattle, horses, and mules as well, lay baking in the sun, around the dried-up wells that had been opened in the hopes of getting water. Not a blade of grass or green thing of any kind relieved the monotony of the parched, ash-colored earth, and the most melancholy scene presented itself that I have seen since I left the Rio Grande. They could hardly have suspected, slogging through the vacant waste.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?